All right. That's good. Okay, good morning, everyone. I hope I didn't create too much confusion last week. Anyway, it was a good getaway. So before we start, first of all, I want to just wish Judy Berman happy birthday. It's her birthday today. When I say birthday, I mean the real birthday, the Jewish birthday. Mazel tov, and a year of great success and happiness ahead. At the same time, also Adele, who's a regular here, it's her special birthday tonight and tomorrow, and wish you also a year of tremendous bracha and success and only good things. So let me just begin with a short review from 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the focus on emotional training, emotional regulation, emotional check-ins, and all this kind of stuff, where we talked about the overemphasizing of it and the rumination of ruminating over our emotions and being in touch with them all the time could actually be damaging. Whereas healthy emotions are very important, but it's the overemphasis that becomes a problem and creates self-absorption and fragility and so on. What we did talk about is that when you have a normal weakness, in other words, the regular emotions that are part of human experience, not things that come from big problems. We'll talk about it a bit today as well, actually. It comes into today's topic. But with normal stuff, we don't need to ruminate over what we're feeling. We need to do 3 things. We need to act, we need to do, rather than think about how we're feeling. We need to actually do. The second thing is, the most very important, is doing for others. We talked about that a lot. And if we do have that kind of thinking that's disturbing us when it's in the normal range of things, the best strategy is to replace our thoughts. You can't stop thinking about something, but you could replace it with something more positive, and we talked about that. Okay. Before we continue, I want to just remind you that in 2 weeks' time, so next week will be the last one of this series. In 2 weeks' time, we're having a special guest on Zoom on the screen, but an amazing guest, who Dvori Kreiman, who has overcome amazing, incredible, unimaginable tragedy and trauma with tremendous pain, but with tremendous resilience and faith and strength, and she'll talk in 2 weeks' time. It'll be on the screen. No, you can come here. No, sorry. Let me just be clear.
What's her name?
Dvori Kreiman. She wrote a book, Even If It Isn't, I think it's called. Please come here, and we'll have questions and answers hopefully at the end, so which will technologically set it up, hopefully, and it should be amazing. Before we get into the topic today, I want to just share with you 2 inspirational things that I saw and heard over the last number of days. As I said, not really related to the topic, but sometimes I just like to share with you things that are nice. The first is a story, because yesterday was Tisha B'Av, sorry, 2 days ago was Tisha B'Av, the day of the destruction of the temple, when we are taught that the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred, and we try and increase in love and in baseless love, as they call it, in order to bring about the redemption. So I heard a beautiful story from my brother-in-law. Actually told it to Dina. So my brother-in-law is a Dina's brother, is a shaliach, is a rabbi, a Chabad rabbi, and Chabad on campus, they call it, in one of the universities of America, in a small town called Chile in California. And recently they had a kinus, they had a gathering, a conference of all the campus shluchim, and they went to Israel, they traveled to Israel. And of course, they visited all the places and the various things that people do nowadays in order to really connect to what is going on there. And one of the places they went to is Sderot, of course. And in Sderot, they met up with a Sephardi rabbi who miraculously was saved on October the 7th. There was violence there, he was miraculously saved, but the way he was saved and the story behind it is quite phenomenal. So what happened was, as you know, in the morning it was Simchat Torah. This rabbi was observant. He had no idea that anything was happening, and he started him start davening very early, or relatively early normally. And he arrived in shul at about 7:30, not understanding why it was empty. As he got there, he heard stuff, he looked towards the police station, he saw there's problems there, and he wanted to try and help. He didn't understand yet what was happening. So he saw a policeman in the street, and he went over to him to see if he could help. By the time he got to the policeman, it was too late. He realized the policeman is not a policeman, it's an Arab dressed as a policeman, as you know, that they did that on October the 7th. So he started to run away. The Arab threw a grenade which didn't explode, but then as he ran away, he shot him and he hit him. And he was bleeding. I'm not sure exactly from where, but he was bleeding and he was wounded. He ran into the shul. He tried to stop, but he couldn't. He had a phone there from before Yontif. He tried to call Hatzalah ambulance hospitals, not knowing, of course, he can't get through to anyone. On October the 7th, he couldn't get through to any emergency service. And there was no one in shul. And he just started to bleed, and he was bleeding. And he came to a point about after half an hour that he's just losing a lot of blood. And he figures, this is it. And he says that he said vidui, which is a Jewish tradition. If you're conscious towards the end of life, you say confession to the tshuva before, you know. And as he was doing that, a kohen gadol walked in and sees him on the floor, and he says, why are you lying on the floor? So he says, I was shot. And the guy thinks he's joking. He says, I'm not joking. I'm actually really wounded. Could you help me? So the guy says, why don't you call, he also didn't know what was going on, obviously. Why don't you call the emergency service? I've tried. And as he was saying that, he remembered that he'd left, that he has his car, because he brought his car before the chag to shul, and he says, here, take my keys, take the car, maybe you can take me somewhere. So he did. He carried him to the car. He managed to get to a hospital. Steyrot is a bigger place. It wasn't as bombarded as some of the other places. And luckily, they did get to a hospital, and actually his life was saved just in time. What's the miracle? Listen to this. Who was this guy that came into shul? He was the most annoying person in the shul. A really annoying, grating person. To the point that everyone had actually come to the rabbi to ask him, to tell him to ask this guy to leave. Because it was just, you know, he's one of these people, you know, there are people sometimes, you know, just create a nuisance, they just create conflict, they, you know. And for some reason, this rabbi decided that he's not going to do that, and on the contrary, he's going to show him love. He said, he'll beat him with love. And he showed him with tremendous love, didn't send him away, and this is the guy that came to shul and saved his life. Yeah, it's an unbelievable story. So I thought I'd share that with you. The other one is just a little thing that I'm going to show you. You know, everyone is saying, we say Psalms, we say Tehillim, ongoing prayer, extra prayer, especially when it gets tense. So I just saw a beautiful post that someone posted, a guy called Shlomo Dror, I don't know who he is, but he obviously lives in Israel. He said, this morning I was in a bakery in Jerusalem. I'm going to read it to you, it's so beautiful. This morning I was a bakery in Jerusalem, this is from a few days ago, and I noticed I was standing behind Natan Sharansky. I summoned my courage and told him I just cited his book this week in a class that I gave on the book of Tehillim. I told my students the inspiring story, I'm sure some of you have read this, the inspiring story of how he kept a tiny book of Tehillim with him at all times, even when he struggles with the authorities back in Russia. Sharansky smiled, reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out that tiny, palm-sized, tattered book of Tehillim. I asked him, wow, do you carry that wherever you go? Sharansky didn't even pause. He replied, actually, it carries me. Just thought that was so beautiful. Okay. To today's topic. So we've spoken about this a while ago, but I want to just today sort of expand it a bit with a particular perspective. And the topic, we're talking about challenging some of the modern thinking and some of the thinking that's risen over the last number of decades, again, partly based on Abigail Shai's book, Bad Therapy. But the topic specifically that we're talking about today is one of trauma, the concept of PTSD, and the effects of trauma. So, first of all, as I always do, let's be very clear, because it's always, as I said, there's always a pendulum fear that if we start talking against something, obviously it goes to the extreme. So we need to be very clear. And the clarity is this, that the awareness of understanding of the concept of trauma over the last few decades is extremely important, and it's a critical development in understanding mental health in general, right? Number two, of course, trauma is a real thing, and the effects are real for those that experience trauma. The effects can be something like post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, when people experience triggers. Sometimes it's like avoidance. People want, after they've experienced trauma in a particular place, they won't go, let's say, into shopping centers if they've experienced trauma in a shop, or they won't go to certain places because it triggers them. Sometimes the way people deal with it is just numbness. They lose emotion. I heard an interesting story the other day. I'm just doing a weekly thing now where it's an overseas thing on Zoom. They're having a sort of a mentorship program for young Chabad rabbis who have to counsel people and so on and so forth. So it's a course that they developed, and I'm just coordinating a weekly discussion on Zoom. And we had a guest last week, an expert on trauma, and he told an interesting story. He told the story of a young student, a yeshiva student, who's older already, who came to see him. He's a therapist. He came to see him for one thing, but it turned out something else. He came to see him for social anxiety. He was kind of a bit shy. But otherwise, he was a regular guy studying in yeshiva, compliant, davening, doing whatever he needs to do. Normal, sort of, apparently normal, healthy guy. And in the course of the discussion, it came out that he understood from this guy that he's like lacking. He doesn't have any emotion. Like, he doesn't feel. He's like, just everything is just, he's very robotic, in other words, in terms of his. So he asked him, it was an interesting thing itself, like sometimes, you know, a therapist is culturally sensitive, as they call it today. But I mean, this was a religious boy and was a religious counselor. So he said to him, can I ask you a question? I know you daven every day, but, you know, on Rosh Hashanah, and he cited like a very emotional piece of the Rosh Hashanah davening. For those who know about the davening, it's normally an emotional piece. He says, do you feel any different when you say that particular piece or when you just daven a regular weekday sort of Amidah, right? He says, no, davening is davening. It's all the same. So he realized, like, something's wrong with it, right? Anyway, he uncovered that this when he was a young boy, when he was 10 years old or whatever, that this boy had experienced real trauma, especially for a child. Bottom line, he'd come down the stairs one night, and his father had gone to sleep. His father was very young. He'd gone to sleep on the recliner. He sort of just was relaxing, and he died on the recliner. And this little boy saw it, and he was the first one to find his father, and it was very, very traumatic. The problem was, and he explained this, that sometimes part of the healing is to, you know, last week we spoke about not over-focusing on emotions, but when you go through trauma, you do need to. And no one had given him that permission to do it, because everyone got very busy with arrangements and doing everything else after not such a long time. His mother remarried. No one ever really dealt with him. And the way he dealt with it was, sometimes it's PTSD. He didn't have PTSD, but he had numbness. He just numbed his emotions because it was too hard to deal with, right? So that can be an effect of trauma. He actually said a very interesting thing, that sometimes not even a matter of someone expressing their emotions, about the permission to do it. In other words, it's knowing to just open the door and say, if you want to talk and if you want to express your emotions, that kind of thing already is part of the healing, which was very interesting. Okay. So, therefore, there is, in the process of healing, there's been a number of interventions, a number of therapeutic things that they've introduced to deal with trauma in different ways. Some of them are very effective and incredibly important for the person who's looking and seeking healing. However, this is the but. Like many areas of mental health, so I hope that's clear, because that is important and I don't want to undermine that. But like many areas of mental health, for whatever reason, as we'll highlight later maybe, it sometimes becomes very overused. And actually, the way it's overused becomes damaging rather than healing, right? Now, with trauma, we see this two ways. First of all, even when someone experiences real trauma, the professionals that do the healing, or some of them at least, or the world, or the culture, because of the awareness discovered and understood about trauma, what they've often started to do is to focus only on the trauma rather than focusing on resilience. And even we'll see later how bad this has become. And even focusing on resilience generally, in other words, instilling resilience into people when they're very young, talking about resilience, talking about the inner strength that we all have, right? And therefore becomes very focused on, oh, the trauma you have, that must be terrible, and only focusing on dealing with trauma rather than focusing generally or together with at least uncovering or exposing or discovering or connecting to the great and unbelievable resilience that often people do have or they can develop, right? That's the first thing that's happened. The second thing is that what's happened has become such a loose word, trauma, that people have started using the word trauma and not even using it. I mean, some people use it like, you know, when a person wants to be dramatic, so they say, oh, I was traumatized yesterday by meeting my grade three teacher and I was such a bad boy in a car, something like that, right? Okay, obviously we know that when they say they don't mean actual trauma, right? Just been used. Although it's probably not a good idea to use trauma so much, but people do it. I'm talking about actually overusing in the sense where people use it therapeutically. In other words, they call things trauma and treat it like trauma when it's clearly not trauma. And that's very damaging. We'll see later why. So let's break this down a little bit. So in her book, there's a big chapter and I'm going to take some of it. And she begins this chapter with an incredible story of her grandmother, Abigail Shire's grandmother. And I'll just read you parts of it. She was obviously an amazing woman with tremendous strength. And she had an incredibly hard life and eventually made it very well. And she became, a district judge, something. Otherwise, she made something of herself in an amazing way. And he says like this: my maternal grandmother, the most optimistic and can-do woman I've known, when she was born 1927, her mother died giving birth to her. So that was the first thing, right? That, by the way, that can be actual trauma also, even though they don't realize when they're born, obviously, right? For the first few years of her life, a series of indifferent cousins in D.C. and Philadelphia were called upon to nurse and house her, never given enough milk. My grandmother were very poor. Her teeth got affected and her nutrition, or lack of nutrition, stunted her growth. Her widowed father was obviously a bit dysfunctional. He couldn't raise her for whatever reason. And then she says, when my grandmother turned six, she had a first real stroke of good luck. Her eldest sister, Claire, met a boy. They married and they took her in. But then what happened was when she was 16, she got a terrible headache. She had a lot of symptoms. They called the doctor, took her to the hospital, and who confirmed the diagnosis of spinal bilar polio. Right away, they took her to the hospital, that they were doing like those days. Claire, her sister, her older sister, burnt all her clothing. I don't think I do that anymore. They have different systems of how they understand contagious disease. Anyway, but she was hospitalized almost a year. She turned 17 in an iron lung, struggling to breathe and unable to swallow. Family visits were like through a hallway window, a wave, a smile. The dreaded illness lasted a year until one day my grandmother's tongue enlivened enough to negotiate a teaspoon of water. Nurses crowded around her bedside to witness her first sips and so on. So she'd missed school. She'd gone through this year. It is a traumatic experience and that kind of magnitude. But she says she didn't let any of this get in the way with her. She eventually, they were a very poor family, didn't finish school. The whole thing she completed, eventually she went to school, she completed law school at night and became one of the first female judges in Maryland's history. And until the last year of her life at 94, a sharp mind softened with age, she held fast to a feeling that she would never leave her, that every day was a miracle and she never complained, everything was amazing. Right? So she says this, she says, my motherless grandmother endured poverty, polio and world war. And yet it would never have occurred to her to respond to a survey in the way an apparently typical American young man born in 1990 recently did. He responded, that young man, I've grown up in the 21st century where disasters happen every 20 minutes. Right? Or another young man responding to the same survey, born in 1999, who somehow managed to drag himself out of bed to offer the sunny thought, we have no future and no hope, we are at the end of history. Right, this is the gap between the two people. So, what her grandmother experienced, obviously, was traumatic. And let's just define trauma, by the way. I know we did this once before, but let's just do it for revision purposes. So, in the literature, we learn about two types of trauma. One's a big T and one's a small T. Both trauma, but the big T trauma means a single event. An event which is completely abnormal that can really affect a person, like that young boy who found his father in the recliner, like someone is in a terrible car accident, like a soldier seeing terrible things in war, someone who was subject to abuse, sexual abuse or other forms of abuse and things like that, right? That's traumatic events, can be one time and they can have a lasting effect, and they could induce PTSD when that's triggered, person can go back and relive the trauma. Small trauma is normally happens when a person is younger. Small trauma means small things that happen to a person but happen multiple times over a long period of time. Right? So they just describe it as 1,000 small cuts. If a person has 1,000 small cuts, they're a mess, right? This can be like parental neglect over a period of time, it can be bullying over a period of time, and so on, right? So, sorry? Yeah.
I think it's worse.
It could be worse, yeah. It doesn't normally result in PTSD, it results in other things. In other words, because it's not a one event that you relive, right? So PTSD is when you trigger and you relive a particular event. This brings all sorts of other issues, right? And it can be a very dysfunctional life. Okay, so her first point, obviously, is that with her grandmother, even though it was real trauma, but a human being does have, and we find that often, a human being does have an amazing ability, more than we think, to be resilient, especially with time, right? So the power, this is the first point, the power of resilience should never be underestimated. Just like the effects of trauma shouldn't be underestimated, but we also shouldn't underestimate the power of resilience which human beings have. Which goes back, she brings this as well, but I've shared this with you before. It goes back to the research of George Bernanen, who did this research after 9/11, who so many people who watched the towers fell and were really traumatized initially actually did not develop PTSD. All the clinics and all the unbelievable clinics that they built in anticipation for thousands and thousands of people who would need therapy were empty. Obviously, they were used by some, but they underestimated the innate and essential resilience that people actually have, right? Especially people, you know, so this going back to her grandmother, for example, who suffered really terrible things, but just in general, you know, I think it's important to think about it before we continue the discussion about just people who had really rough lives, you know. I think I've shared this with you before, but when I was reading this, when I was studying trauma ideas, I started thinking about my own grandfather, who I never thought as I was a traumatized person. Because when I knew him, he was an incredibly healthy human being, like on all levels. Like he was, I mean, physically, he was physically healthy, but he was also just healthy emotionally, ran and did for, just he had like an inner joy of life. He would do so much for others. He was just like a busy person, famous rabbi in South Africa and so on. And I heard stories of his childhood when I was growing up. I never realized, it was stories from the past, you know what I'm saying? But really, when I grew older, I realized actually it was a really rough life. He was a child. His mother died of starvation. I mean, they were incredibly poor, right? The family had no money. He lived in real poverty. Eventually, he had to leave school because they wanted him, as a young boy, they wanted him to work so he should help the family. He really wanted to learn and study, so eventually he actually ran away to a yeshiva. Anyway, it's a long story, but he had a really rough life, right? And yet, he never talked about it. I mean, he would mention it once in a while. Like when he wanted to tell us that, you know, we have it good, you know, we have a good life, you say, you know, my mother died. By the way, he also had a stepmother that wasn't very good to him, but, right, so, which is, you know, always traumatic, right? And you would never know. You would never know. Right? And this is something that she makes. She makes the following point. She says, then something changed, she says, in society. Right? We surrender our faith in the native human ability to overcome hardship and told our kids they could not possibly recover, let alone emerge stronger. This is the problem in our society. That we tell people that if you suffer that kind of hardship, it's very hard to recover, certainly difficult to emerge stronger. That's become the culture. And that's a very bad shift. And that's a shift that's somewhat influenced, badly influenced, and it shouldn't be that way because there is real trauma, which needs intervention. But somehow it's become so extreme that this is the message that we're selling people, and therefore people are now looking at crazy things or things that are hard, but not traumatic, and defining them as trauma, right? Now, I just want to clarify one thing, because Abigail Schreier in the book does tend to be a little bit extreme, and I made this point in the first year, that we don't have, we don't want to, addressing this and confronting this issue, we don't want to be suffer from the same problem of the pendulum syndrome, of going to the back to the other extreme, right? Because there's no question that there are people who suffered real trauma in their youth that did affect them. And the obvious example is the Holocaust, right? There's no question that people who went through the Holocaust, even those that built really good lives afterwards and did amazing things, they were affected. There's no question. Unfortunately, at that time, they did not have the tools that we have today to experience healing. They didn't have that. And therefore, often passed it on to the next generation. And there's all these studies on it, etc., right? But that's an extreme thing, right? And had they had the tools or the willingness to actually open up and express their emotions and engage in the tools that we have today, things might have been different. I don't know. But I mean, that's a tremendous possibility. Although even then they were amazing. I mean, the resilience on some level at least was incredible. The way so many of them came and rebuilt their lives in so many amazing ways, right? But what we're talking about is a bit different. We're talking about people who didn't go through the Holocaust. We're talking about people that had tough lives, just tough lives, right? Bordering on trauma. Didn't always have to be that way. Some of them just emerged, like her grandmother, like my grandfather, not as bad as her grandmother, but and many others who just built very healthy lives, right? And I think what's even more problematic is that what's happened today, even with people who, as I said before, that did really experience real big trauma, but we've slipped very much into focusing on the trauma and not enough done to foster resilience. And I think that's one of the main problems, right? Now, where this comes out really badly is in childhood, right? What we're starting to do to the younger generations. Wrote this down somewhere. They have something called ACE kids, ACE, which is, I forgot now, but it's some acronym about childhood adversity or something. Adverse childhood experience or something, right? And people are sort of when kids go to therapists now in school, often what happens is they dig to find out, okay, so what happened in your childhood? Like, what adverse child experience did you have that is the reason why you're struggling, right? And she says, you know, clobbered by four adverse childhood experiences which should spell all kinds of physical and behavioral problems, right? And she says, correctly so, and I've heard this so much now, but they talk about today trauma-informed education, which is complete rubbish, right? We are, as a culture, enthralled by the notion of childhood trauma, weary of inflicting it, eager to spot it. Books that insist that we all have hidden trauma from our childhoods live on bestseller lists. Those are the bestsellers today, the ones that will tell you that you have trauma. By the way, if we go with the way, I can guarantee you in this room, including me, if we go with what is today the modern way of doing things, we'll all discover trauma in our childhood, guaranteed. Some of you probably had it a bit more real, some of you didn't, but we'll all have it, right? And what a relief is it to discover our own trauma. So that's why I'm needy. That's why I can't get to work on time. That's why I struggle to maintain relationships. It lets us off the hook. It isn't that we overlook significant character flaws and romantic partners or that, but it's a reason to blame for the way we are. And often happens, and it's happening more and more as people are getting younger and younger. Now, she goes on to explain, you know, she points out that it's something very hard to disprove. I don't know this word, but it's unfalliable or something, right? No, because you know, like, it's easy to blame something happened to your childhood. You can't actually prove it, but we can say that's why it is. You know, that kind of thing, right? Now, what's also developed is this, and in case you can't find any trauma, in case you really look, you just can't find trauma in your childhood, which will explain all your weaknesses. Right, we've forgotten that every human being has weaknesses, as we discussed last week. But if you can't find any trauma, so don't worry, they've come to the rescue. So one of the great best-selling books on trauma, one of the trauma gurus, is a guy called, I quoted him last time we did stuff on trauma, is Bessel van der Kolk. The Body Keeps Score, right? And everyone loves it. Why? Because it fits in with this narrative. If you can't find trauma, it doesn't matter, because your mother had trauma or your grandmother had trauma, and it gets, well, first of all, if you have trauma you don't remember, your body will keep it. So even if you had a traumatic experience when you were young, the body keeps score, you will never have gotten rid of it, even if you can't remember it, right? Now, by the way, that can sometimes happen, that's true. That sometimes people do push things into the suppressed memory or consciousness, even though it's a controversial topic, but it could happen, right? Second of all, what Bessel van der Kolk talked about, and Gabo Mate talks about this a lot, is intergenerational trauma. So if you can't find any trauma, it's either because you have hidden trauma and your body's keeping score, so if you have a headache or you've got some sort of ailment, it's definitely because of trauma, even if you can't discover it and can't find it, it's there because your body's keeping score. And if you can't find, if you don't have any trauma, it's your grandmother's trauma or your grandfather's trauma, right? So she says, all that would suggest that his theory of childhood trauma, which he terms the hidden epidemic, ought to be taken very, very seriously. What's the catch? According to several of the greatest academic psychologists and psychiatrists alive today, van der Kolk's theory amounts to a bill of goods. That's what she says. Her word. A bill of goods. In other words, it's nothing, right? Now, she does go, and I'm not going to go through it now, but if you read the book, you'll see some fascinating chapters there of how his research was, a lot of people claim that his research was actually flawed. Now, okay, there's two views. I happen to think that she's right because, you know, I look at things through a Jewish lens and a Torah lens, and I don't think the Torah's view is that the body keeps score at all. We believe, and obviously our past experiences informs the present. Obviously it has an effect, but to that extent, I don't think that's true. In other words, the power of resilience and the power of a freshness of each day, the Modeh Ani theory, and the whole way that we are taught responsibility, as we'll talk about in a moment, from the Torah's perspective, is very, very, very different. When I first read it, that was the popular book to read, and I thought, okay, it sounds a bit extreme, but okay, if that's the research, that's the research. And it bothered me because I didn't fit with my value system at all. And now that I've discovered that actually it's very under question, it makes a lot of sense. Where I really started to question is when I read Gabo Mate stuff, which I didn't trust anyway because I don't trust him in lots of things. But he is unbelievably extreme. And I've heard this saying, like there's, just recently, part of this course I'm doing, there was a whole discussion about addiction, right? So now the new theory is any person who develops addiction must have had trauma, right? Which is nonsense. Now, it is possible that trauma can eventuate in addiction. That is true. Because you numb the pain or whatever, or numb the shame, whatever the case is. So people, it's known that people who are, a lot of addicts will talk about their maybe sexual abuse that they experience as children. That is all true. But to say that everyone who has an addiction had trauma is nonsense, because we know that people are predisposed to addiction, and that sometimes, I challenge someone another day on this, they tell you, well, if you're predisposed to addiction, then maybe that's also trauma. I don't know what that means. Like, that's ridiculous, okay? So just people have different weaknesses and exposure, like exposure, creating an alcohol culture, or creating a gambling culture, that kind of thing, won't make everyone addicted, but it can certainly make people who are predisposed to be addicted, and that's a big problem. And that's why dealing with addiction, we have to deal with culture, right? So, but according to Gabo Mate, everything, addiction, illness, all forms of illness, all forms of cancer, everything is all to do with trauma, even if you're too nice, he says. Right? If you find it hard to create boundaries and to say no, it's also because of childhood trauma. It's crazy. I'm sorry. It's just absolutely crazy. Now, so I'll just share with you one more thing before we get into it a bit. She says that there was, I don't know who this is, but there's a New York best-selling therapist and advice giver to 7 million Instagram followers. Her name is Nicole LaPera. Apparently, she promises the power to heal herself and so on and so forth, right? So she says, do you struggle in relationships? This is one of the things she said. Are you struggling in relationships? Fear abandonment and don't like asking for help? This is one thread. You might have been parentified.
You might have been what?
Parentified. You know what parentified is? No, nor did I. But so it's a new term. What's parentified? Parentified means it's an invisible form of trauma. It's a new kind of trauma. What is that? It's not recognized inside. It occurs when parents look to their children to provide emotional support and to run parts of the household. It's a role reversal. Now, I'm not saying it's a good thing. Parents shouldn't do this. But it doesn't cause trauma, right? But apparently it does. And she says the following. Adults who have been parentified can struggle with, and here's the list. Now, you tell me if you're not on this list, okay? If you're not on this list, you're in the wrong room. But, right? Because we're all on this list. You might struggle with, I mean, at least one of these things, right? Communication skills, inability to understand their emotions, inability to meet their own needs, hyper independence, like I could do it all alone. I just thought that was a Jewish thing. But Apparently it's a trauma thing. Fear of asking for help or accepting it. Anyone have that? Anyone doesn't like to accept help yet? Okay. Emotional maturity, high reactivity, defensiveness in relationships, codependency patterns, patterns of self-betrayal, low self-worth, lack of sense of self. Every second person has these things. Every person has some of these things, right? It's not because you're parentified, and parentified is not a form of trauma anyway, right? And it's really a shame because it almost like becomes offensive to people who actually experience real trauma. I'm just giving you all these examples to see where this is going, and we need to be aware and hypersensitive about it because it is stands in the way of real growth. This is not just an academic discussion. This is a discussion that's relevant to each and every one of us. Why? Because the truth is that the question is, why is this happening? Why is this happening, right? So, I mean, she has a bit of a sinister view. She says it's got to do with the therapist's self-interest of making money. I think that's a bit hard. That's a bit sharp. But I think the two reasons I think, and she alludes to them as well, is this. The first thing is, like, why is it that people had such hard lives, like some of our grandparents, and yet were so strong, and why we find it so difficult, and our children and grandchildren find it even more difficult? And I think it has to do with something I mentioned when we did the series on anxiety, and that is because we live in a good world, or used to at least, because we live in a world where there's affluence and everything, and we have everything.
And nobody would have listened to them then, and over here everybody indulges us.
Indulges us, but it's more than that. It's also because we have become hyper-allergic to being uncomfortable. We don't know how to be uncomfortable, right? So if we don't get what we want right away, if we turn on the computer, we can't get to the channel we're looking for right away. If the internet one day out of 65 is a little bit slow, we completely lose it, right? So obviously, if someone says something mean to us, or child for sure, we just fall apart and we just don't know how to handle discomfort. If we don't know how to handle discomfort, then every discomfort, especially when it's a little bit more than normal, becomes traumatic. And therefore, this is part of the culture. But I actually think there's another reason, and I think this probably contributes to a lot of it. And that is the lack of purpose. We live in a world, it's all connected to hedonism and indulgence and so on. Purpose. There's a tremendous lack of purpose. We know this because in all demographics and in all groups of people, there's a tremendous push away from religion, right? The rabbis are not only the only ones complaining, it's all the priests and everyone, right? Because there's an amazing shift away from religion, or religious engagement at least, or religious identification. Because people have found pleasure in the indulgence of our society. They found pleasure in immediate pleasure, in other words, gratification, immediate, instant gratification. And that's fed into the ego over many, many years, and we've become very immersed in it. And therefore, we've lost our sense of purpose. When we lose our sense of purpose, then we can't handle adversity. It's very simple. Purpose and handling toughness and hardship is extremely related. Right? I've often shared with you, and that purpose can be any purpose, by the way. I mean, obviously, in Judaism, we talk about a higher purpose, but every person needs to live with a higher purpose. Viktor Frankl 101, right? You have to live for meaning. And if you don't, you become unhappy, you become anxious. And also becomes very hard to endure things because you don't have a meaning to endure it for, right? I've often told you about a great Hasidic Jew that I knew, not very personally and very well, but I knew he was, and I saw him many times, called Reb Mendel Futterfass. I've told you about him. He was a great Hasid. Talk about trauma. He spent 10 years, 12 years in Siberia under extremely harsh conditions. He eventually came out and joined his family in England when his adult married daughter had a car accident and passed away. Right? That's a hard life. I never saw the guy without a smile. He was, and it wasn't a fake smile. He wasn't bearing his emotions. He was a very healthy guy. But he was a person with such purpose. Just loved the mitzvah. He loved serving God. He loved his fellow Jew. He had this incredible selflessness and incredible purpose. And there's no question to me that got him through. That got him through in the Gulag. It got him through in Siberia. He talked about it. Yes, the thigh trap. That's right, yes. So just to mention it quickly. He was the one that when he told the story, that in the gulag he saw someone, they were sitting there, prisoners one day, the Cossacks and him, and they had a bit of free time. I don't know, the supervisors weren't driving them crazy. So one guy says that before, they were talking about what they did before they arrived there. And one guy was a political prisoner, he says he was a tightrope walker. And he says, look, I'm going to show you. So they took two trees, they put a string, and he did it, and he did the stunt for all the prisoners. So Remendel Futtevaz was very curious, and he always liked, like the Baal Shem Tov, always liked to learn a lesson from everything. So he said, how do you do this? Like, how is it done? And I think he answered, if I remember correctly the story, he said to him that you've always got to focus on the goal. So if you look to the right or the left, you will fall. If you look to where you're going, you can make it. And he said that's what got him through. He says that's what he was thinking about all the time. He's right. I just meant even when you can't do anything, right? Even when there's a potential purpose, there was a, I mentioned on Tisha B'Av in the nighttime, there was a great rabbi, a Lithuanian rabbi. His name was Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, and he lived in Russia also around that time. And he also landed up in Siberia in a gulag. And he tells a story that he was a little bit down one day, and he woke up and he thinks to himself, what am I waking up for? They took away my tefillin, I can't pray, I don't have other people, I don't have a shul, I don't have friends, I don't have family, I don't have anyone I could do, like, nothing. What am I waking up for? Until he said, he realized, when he woke up and he said, Modeani, he realized that he has his faith. And he said, faith is something you can nurture and you can exercise anywhere. You don't need your tefillin, you don't need your mezuzah, you don't need your shul, you don't need your friends, you don't need your family. Faith comes with you because it lives inside. He said that was his purpose. So those few years, his purpose was to exercise his faith. Okay? So that's how he expressed his purpose. Because purpose can come with you wherever you go. It's just applied differently in different circumstances, right? So the sense of purpose is so important, but also the sense of unique purpose. There was there's a book, I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. There's a book which has now been just published. I might do a series of it, I said, like in maybe next term. But there's a book that's published with different topics of well-being from, they've collected stories and anecdotes and letters from the Lubavitcher Rebbe and with introductions, very, very well done. And he says that there's a reason, there has to be a reason to fight. There's a reason for you to be resilient. There's a reason why you need to be here, right? What that means is, and he quotes from a letter that the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, once wrote to a teenager who was talking about the despondency and you know, lack of drive and so on and so forth. And he said to her, or I think it was him or her, that you're understandably said the Rebbe, I don't agree with all the foundations upon which you construct your views of yourself and your subsequent conclusions, right? And he goes on to talk about the following. He says like this. He said, if you wish to heed my advice, continue your studies next year, but in addition to your studying, you should also involve yourself with providing education. It will be best to do several times a week for someone else. In other words, my intent is you organize a group of children and be their counselor and teach them. In other words, give. Have a purpose to get through this hard time, right? Think to yourself, he says, there is so much to accomplish in the world. There's so much potential in every single person, but because of the vast amount of work to be done, we can't afford to give up on even one capability or talent. It's a very important thing. See, purpose also comes with the understanding that each person has, you know, God gave us a moral code, and he gave us a formula, right? Which is universal and applies to each and every one of us, but we each have a unique way of expressing it. Each way have an area of emphasis. And this concept, I think I spoke about it once, about the Talmud says, Bishvili nivra olam, that a person should always say, the world was created for me. Now, that's not meant as a permission to be arrogant, God forbid, but actually on the contrary. The world was created for a higher purpose, and I have a unique contribution to that purpose. Right? I might have a talent in one area, I might have a means to do something, I might have the opportunity to do one good thing, and I can't rely on the rest of the world. Like people will think, so why does it have to be me? So the concept is when we live for a purpose and we get through a hard time because of purpose, not just because we have a general purpose, we have a purpose that's specific to me, my contribution. And that's what we have to understand, that we all have, we're indispensable, so to speak, in that sense, right? There's a woman who lived in South Africa, I remember her. Her name was Ruth Benjamin. Ruth Benjamin, I remember very well actually, she was close to our family, but she was born a Christian, she was born to Christian parents, and later on she converted, and she built quite a connection with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And she was a clinical psychologist, and she once asked the Rebbe, what should she tell patients and clients who question the value of their own life? So she said like this, that obviously I had Jewish patients and non-Jewish patients. Essentially, the Rebbe told her to give a different answer to each one, but essentially it was the same answer. Because the answer was purpose. She said, regarding my Jewish patients, she said, I should tell them that following the Holocaust, with so many millions of our people murdered, those alive today have a double duty. They must live not only for themselves, but also for those that are not here. And they realize this, they find that their own turmoil will be eased. In other words, the purpose, the urgency of the purpose has become more. And then he says, with regard to the non-Jews, and they need to understand that every human being has a purpose. And he went on to talk about what we call in Judaism, the seven Noahide laws, right? We have this principle that the Jews were given a big Torah with 630 mitzvot, but the world at large was also, part of the Torah's giving was also instructing the nations of the world with seven basic moral laws, monotheism, and then not to steal, not to kill, and not to commit adultery, to be faithful, not to, and so on, and to live a life of law and order. So you need to spread that and spread that higher purpose. Every person, every human being has a purpose. So that's what you need to do. You need to communicate to the people that purpose, right? And she said that she cited as an example of a suicidal patient who, she says, I managed to get to the hospital in time, saving his life. This is an interesting line. Afterwards, he came to me and he said, you are responsible for my being alive. Now give me something to live for. Right? I think that's very... If someone is able to communicate that, it's quite powerful, actually, right? And it's a good question. He says, okay, now you kept me alive. What for? So it's got to be purpose, right? And I think this is part of the problem. Part of the problem is that we don't have a purpose. We don't have a higher being. And therefore, we're very resistant to being uncomfortable. We don't do hardship very well. And also, another very important thing is, and fundamental to Judaism, as we've talked about many, many times, is that therefore people are slipping away from taking responsibility. When you have a purpose, and God has given you the choice to choose that purpose, then you are responsible. That's why foundational to Judaism is the concept of Bechira. You have a choice. You could choose not to do it, you could choose yes to do it. But when you don't have a purpose, and life is just random, and it's full of just pursuing pleasure, then no one wants to take responsibility. We just feed the ego all the time, and therefore I need to blame everyone else and everything else or something else for my problems. Right? If I have a purpose in this world, and it's my unique purpose that God has given me, whether it's a special mitzvah that I have to do, or a special favor that I have to do for someone, or whatever it is, an area of holiness, an area of purpose, an area of mitzvah, an area of goodness that I have to accomplish in this world, then I'm responsible to live it to the fullest. I'm responsible to choose that purpose. And therefore, I own my own story. Nothing else and no one else. Yes, of course, there's people. Obviously, we impact people and people impact us. That's true. But at the end of the day, my life is my choice and I have to take responsibility. That concept of responsibility is also slipping away tremendously nowadays. Right? But because of the same thing, because there's this whole, it's just me and just, it's about me and it's about my pleasure and it's about my enjoyment, about my living life, about my ego. Therefore, I don't want to be impacted by anything. And if anything's wrong and if anything's getting in the way, it's something else. Which is why we have this culture now where you take stupid things that happen when a person is a child or younger or anything, and it's trauma. We have this stupid thing called trauma-informed education, where we make a checklist and we find some trauma. If you didn't have it, it's your grandparents' trauma. And therefore, that's the way you are like you are. Now, there is real trauma. That's the point. And real trauma will affect you. And real trauma does compromise the choice you have. And therefore, it needs healing and needs intervention to get back to a healthy place of choice. But the regular hardships in life, the regular personality weaknesses, like we said last week, the regular stuff that we go through, that's just living. And living comes with problems. Every person has challenges. Every person has friends when they were young and didn't treat them nicely. Every person has teachers they didn't like. Every person has imperfect parents. Every person has there's no perfect parents in the world. So we all have things that we could blame, but that's just life. And life means that we learn to We learn to get on with it. We learn to give to others. We learn to follow our purpose. And we learn to make a choice and to take responsibility for ourselves. Not to look for things why we are like that. We are like that. There's 100 reasons. Nature, nurture, all of it. But nothing affects us really. We're not bound by anything. It's all true, but we're not bound by any of it because we take responsibility. And when we take responsibility, then we start to discover and to connect to the incredible power of resilience that we actually have. Some have it more than others. Some can work in it. Martin Seligman said you can learn optimism, you can learn resilience, and we can. Why can we? Because deep down we all have it. Sometimes we need a longer journey than others. The speaker in 2 weeks' time, obviously that's real trauma. That was a journey, and you'll hear about the journey. But it was a journey, a positive journey. It wasn't a journey where she just slipped into blaming everything that happened to her. She did initially because it was so hard, and that's stuff that can really be understandable. But still, with faith, with resilience, with tremendous power, she worked through it. You'll hear about it in 2 weeks' time, which is actually amazing. I'll just end with one thing that I mentioned on Isha B'Av, but it's really connected to the whole week that we just had. Because this is the point, right? The point is, so the Talmud says a very funny story. Talmud says that there were the wise men of Athens, that came to one of the Talmudic sages and said, I want to challenge you with a bunch of questions. And it's a very cryptic piece of the Talmud. One of the questions they asked him was, they gave him two white eggs. And they told him, two white eggs, yeah. And they asked him, one of these eggs was born from a white chicken and the other one was born from a black chicken. Can you tell us which one it is? Of course he couldn't, right? So what was going on there? Now, the commentaries explain the following. That there's two times of the year where we have a period of 21 days, which apparently is the time that an egg incubates or something, right? And that's from Rosh Hashanah till the end of Sukkot, which is a beautiful, amazing, happy time of the year. And the 21 days of the 3 weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av we had 2 weeks ago, which is a time of we mourn the tragedies and difficulties and challenges that happened to the Jewish people and are still happening to the Jewish people. And the question was, which egg is it? Is it one born from the black egg, black chicken? That's the 21 days of hardship. Or the one born from the 21 days of happiness? And the answer is that they're exactly the same. Because in Jewish thinking, not only do we take responsibility and not only do we overcome difficulty, as we've talked about many times, but we actually use it as a journey of growth. We grow from the difficulty. Not only do we survive it, we grow from it. That's that concept of PTG that I've shared with you many times, post-traumatic growth, right? And then he says the eggs are identical. Doesn't matter where they come from, they produce. Because God did design life where there is ups and downs. Even normal ups and downs. There's normal challenges of life, not the super traumatic ones. Even those can be a catalyst for growth. But even the normal challenges, which nowadays I like to call trauma, they're just part of life. They're not the uncomfortable part of life. They're bumps in the road, but they're part actually designed to be part of the journey of life, becoming stronger and becoming more powerful and using it as a part of the rebuilding and the growth that every human being is supposed to experience. Okay, so next week we'll do one more topic on this and then we'll have two one-offs in 2 weeks' time, a guest speaker, and then we'll do another topic towards the end of the term.
Being spoiled.
Okay. Yeah,
That's
all.
That's what it is.
That's the colloquial way of saying it.
That's exactly right. You just get on with your life and it's like. And also, the lack of family today.
Yeah, also.
That's the biggest.
But also because of lack of purpose. All the same
no,
thing.
But the same with what you're saying with religion. There's no. The Jewish, any religion is bankrupt.